The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is Saturday at 10 a.m. and you are tuned into Radio Kingston, and that means that it is time for some Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and if you happen to be joining this program for the first time, this show is all about exploring and celebrating the amazing natural world that we are so lucky to be surrounded by here in the Mid-Hudson Valley, with the estuary and the Catskills and beyond. And yeah, we do this by bringing on a guest live in the studio every week. And I'm delighted to have Derek Furr, author and literature professor at Bard, live in the studio with us this morning. Thanks for being here, Derek.
No, I'm so glad you asked me to come. Thanks, Laurel.
Absolutely. So as I said, this show is about, you know, bringing in a little deeper understanding about what might you see if you walk outside and slow down a little bit and observe. And I'll speak for myself. These are some dark and distressing times, and it can feel like pretty overwhelming, and it can feel like everything I care about is under attack day to day. And I think it's at times like these that it's more important than ever that we remember the tremendous beauty and that it's still out there surrounding us in the natural world. And I think we all know that it makes us happier and more sane if we spend time in nature. Physically, mentally, our well-being is improved, but sometimes we can lose sight of that in the day-to-day. So, you know, ultimately, I would love it if this show could serve as some inspiration for folks to, you know, remember that fundamental truth and take some time to go outside. And, you know, if it's deep up a river or a mountain in the Catskills, that's great. But it's incredible how much, surrounds us right here in Midtown Kingston even. So you don't have to do anything particular to get that hit of the natural world. You just have to step outside. So for me, one of the driving ideas behind this show is that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So with that, I'm going to start us off with a section we do every week called Who's About Town. And Who's About Town is sort of like Society Pages, but for the more than human life. And this is an incredible time of year to be a naturalist. We just obviously had the equinox on Thursday. So that means that now, astronomically, it is officially spring in the Northern Hemisphere. Equinox, you know, the etymology there, the word origin is, I think, Latin, but it's equal night. And so equinox, right, at least at the equator, is when you have the sun directly overhead at noon. And so that means equal days, equal nights. And so in a very literal sense, and, you know, referring to the dark times that we are sometimes having right now, in a literal sense, we are now turning towards the light. And we will start to have, you know, more light than darkness in our 24-hour days. So I find that to be a deeply auspicious time. and, you know, everybody can see it. You know, the bulbs are starting to poke up through the soil. The buds are starting to swell on the trees right here in town. I saw my first sweat bee. I was sitting on a bench down at the Rondout earlier this week, those days it almost hit 70 degrees, and a little native bee just, you know, landed right on my hand. So those are some just, you know, there's a lot of undeniable harbingers of spring. And another interesting one, I wouldn't blame you if you'd missed it, but you also may well have seen it, because I was walking just on the little pavement, you know, path right here on the Midtown Linear Park a couple days ago, and I noticed that the path was littered with little gray moths. And at first I thought, well, maybe these are spongy moths, which of course are an invasive, you know, non-native that we've had, you know, big infestations of in past years in the region. But I pulled out my trusty little app, Seek, which is a free app you can put on your phone connected to iNaturalist. And sure enough, it just, without a pause, identified it as a half-wing moth. And then just the next day, I took a walk at night, kind of down one side and then back out the other side of the Wirt Street Bridge down over the Rondeau, and noticed they were everywhere all along the pathway there too. And then if I looked out into kind of the dark, I could see them, you know, they were clearly abundant. And so they're known as, when they're in caterpillar form, they're known as spiny loopers. And they're kind of cool looking. They've got stripes and little orange spots. But then when they become a moth, you know, they're just, I don't know, inch across, pretty plain looking little moth. But I looked into their life cycle a little bit, and they feed, the caterpillars feed on the new growth of a lot of our hardwoods here, elms and maples and other things. But the moths themselves emerge right now. This is their time, like in the second to third week of March, they explode, they have a giant hatch, they're everywhere, and then often by the end of March, they're none to be seen. So, that was a new one for me, and is a very particular punctuation on the season, mm-hmm. that this is the time of the half-wing moths. And another creature who's having its moment right now, and this one is harder to ignore, are the spring peepers. And you know, whether you're deeply familiar with them or whether you don't know what they are, they really will not be ignored. Spring peepers are actually a kind of tree frog, I learned. They're just about an inch long, and if you get up close to one, they have sort of a distinctive X-shaped blotch on their back. But mostly you're unlikely to see that. But when they come out, and these are incredible little frogs, they have what's known as, it's like a biological antifreeze in their blood, which is just allows them to, even though they're an amphibian, allows them to come out even when, it's late, feels like late winter, early spring, still could be very cold. And so they emerge and they are ready to go. They start to sing, and they are known to be able to be heard from more than a mile away. And they like vernal pools. They like sort of slow ponds, bodies of water, and especially if they're kind of sheltered with a bunch of sort of overgrowth. And so they'll come out by the hundreds, thousands, I don't know, tens of thousands. And it's been said that they can sound like sleigh bells at a distance. But even driving down 9W, some of these warm days with the windows open, there'll be times you pass a patch of, you can tell there's a pond in the woods there because the sound is absolutely deafening. So that's really cool. Well, I want to invite you, ask you, Derek, if you, I know you're an observer of the natural world and crisscross the valley, and do you have any observations of spring that you're...
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind, just based on what you were saying, we were walking down at Falling Waters just a couple of days ago and heard the peepers, and that always reminds me of my first time, actually the second time I was ever in this area, which was 20 years ago. Shortly after I got hired at Bard, I was on break as a teacher, and we had just a week to come up and try to find a place to live. And so we came up, and we were staying in a little house near Bard, and that was my first time of being really conscious of spring peepers because they were so loud and amazing. Now every time I hear a spring peeper, I think about that connection. So I guess for us, I mean, this is like right outside our door, but every year we have a nesting pair of house finches, and they just started nesting last week, and the male is letting that be known. Yeah. And that always is a sign to me that things are turning. The light is coming.
Yeah.
Hopefully the house sparrows will let them stay.
Yeah. That's really great. Yeah, I put out a feeder for the first time in my, 30 years of being a birder. This is the first time in my life I've really, put out a feeder. I just gave in, like, all right. And I've been having house finches come recently. And yeah, they're so delightful, with the male with the bright red. And we spoke a bit about this, well, not specifically this, but this topic last week. And house finches are one of the rare ones where females will sometimes sing as well.
Yeah.
And that's really, it's very unusual, and their song is so beautiful and boisterous.
Exuberant.
Sure. Well, that's very cool. I wanted to share another nature nugget who's about town here. And this is from Dwayne Martinez, who's a frequent co-host on the program. And Dwayne works with Scenic Hudson. And he is starting the early stages of what's going to be a 3-year project called Defining Urban Biodiversity. And so he was out with Shaniqua Bowden, a common voice on Radio Kingston and with the Kingston Land Trust. And they were walking around the new property, new-ish property, that the Kingston Land Trust acquired to be the home of the Land in Black Hands program. So this is a 54-acre piece of farm, piece of land that's in the city of Kingston, right on the edge of town, kind of the most upstream part of the Rondout that's part of the city of Kingston. And so that property is, you know, still early in its development stages, but it's evolving into a space for restoration, education, community building, and they're already welcoming visitors and certainly volunteers to help shape the vision of this property. Such a cool thing and a project we will certainly be talking about more on this show. But going back to yesterday, Dwayne and Shaniqua and some other folks were out walking the land, and well, they certainly saw peepers, heard peepers, but he said that they at least two other species of frogs he could distinguish in the soundscape, which is neat. And you know, as the season progresses, you start to get this weaving together of the voices of the frogs, you know. And then as the peepers fade, and then there's others and the bullfrogs and the leopard frogs, and it's pretty cool. But he saw this unusual scat on the ground. Scat is the scientific name for poop, you know, he immediately recognized this is weird. Like, and he could see shells in there. And so he kind of, it stuck in his head and he thought about what it was. And then as he came back and they passed this area again, he was like, I think that's otter. And so he pulled out Seek again, giving a plug for the Naturalist app. And even Seek was able to, you know, pointed at the poop with the cell phone, immediately said American River Otter. And so I just think that is so neat they also on that same walk saw some canine poop. So it could have been fox, could have been coyote. They saw bobcat poop, and they've seen bear live on the land, box turtles. So once again, this is all within the city limits of Kingston. And I just think that's, you know, marvelous. River otters, of course, are just one of the most delightful creatures you could just ever think of coming across and being able to observe. So knowing they're here in Kingston is very heartening for me. Let's see. Focusing on maybe some positive news that I think we all could use right now, I wanted to bring up a little quick story about the Fisher. Fisher is a weasel. It's a giant weasel. The only bigger one is the wolverine. So they can be the size of a house cat. And a Fisher is a pretty fearsome predator. They are known to, you know, fend off, animals larger than themselves. And in fact, they're the only known animal to regularly prey on porcupines because they're just that fierce. They can figure out how to flip it open and get to that soft belly. And Fishers are unusual in that they breed and give birth in the same month, that month generally being March right now. And so they have an extremely long gestation period, basically a full year. And so they have this delayed implantation, which is like other weasels do. And so the female has her, you know, goes into her den and gives birth in March. And then while she has little babies in the den, she goes out, you know, looking for action in the woods and mates, and then comes back, raises those babies, and then a year later isn't until those embryos have gestated again. So that's happening right now, out and about in the Catskills. You can picture these mother fishers out in their dens. And one of the reasons it's such a good news story is that they were basically wiped completely to local extinction in the 1800s in the Catskills. You know, the 1800s were a rough time for the Catskills. They were almost entirely deforested. And so, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands of acres were cleared for farms and timber and you know, the tanning industry. But by the 1900s, as the Fishers had disappeared, But as the forest started to grow back and the nature, you know, as it does, started to show its resilience and heal, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation realized that the conditions had returned. And so they had the bold solution of trapping about 45 fishers from up north in the Adirondacks and Vermont. And then they released them across the Catskills. And by the mid-80s, they had established a viable breeding population. And so now they're not common, but I would also say they're not hyper rare. You do hear people saying, you know, giving sightings, and sometimes people are fearful of them. They are very vicious, and there have been apparently reports of, you know, where they will take a cat that, you know, maybe has wandered into the woods, but really they're incredible animals and ecologically very important creatures. Okay, I'm going to do one more who's about town, and then we're going to move into our main conversation. And this is an interesting one that I just read about recently. And so folks, if you're familiar with birds at all, with any birds, you're likely to know what a hairy or a downy woodpecker is. These are very common backyard birds. They'll come to bird feeders. But even here in Midtown Kingston, I see both of these species regularly, if not every day, you know, every week for sure. And this is kind of the classic little woodpecker that you're familiar with. They're black and white. They've got, the males have a little bit of red on the head, and they're pretty small. But they look almost exactly alike. I mean, down to the marking. If you put a hairy woodpecker next to a downy woodpecker, down to the feathers, the facial features, the wing barring, you know, the tail stripes, like they look exactly alike, except the downy is a bit smaller and has a smaller bill, and it gives him more of kind of a little baby face expression on his face because he's just got this little tiny little bill. And then the hairy is a little bit more robust and a little bit thicker bill, but you know, still we're talking about a 6 or 7 inch bird. And so, you know, the conventional wisdom just has always been that these are closely related species that it, you know, bifurcated a while ago, and one got a little smaller, one got a little bigger. But one of the interesting things about the growth of technology in genetic understanding of animals is that we're finding out all kinds of things that are not what they appear to be on the surface. And one of those is hairy and downy woodpeckers. And it turns out, looking at the genes, they are not that closely related to each other, and they haven't been for a long time. And so, you know, that begs the question, why? You know, this isn't an accident. They're far too precise in their, you know, look alike. And the, you know, spoiler alert is we really don't know why yet. But, you know, the famous naturalist, Victorian era naturalist, Alfred Russel Wallace, you know, proposed this theory of convergent evolution, right? Where evolutionary pressures may, for different reasons, you know, drive unrelated animals to look just alike. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you think about something like a monarch butterfly and why another butterfly would want to look like a monarch, because a monarch feeds on milkweed and which it absorbs the toxins. So a monarch is toxic. So if you're a bird and you eat a monarch once, you're never going to do it again. So that makes perfect sense why another butterfly would want to look like a monarch, because then the bird's not going to want to eat them. But what's going on here with these woodpeckers? And like I said, they really don't know. You know, the first theories were that maybe the bigger one, the hairy woodpecker, was a bully because they share habitat, and maybe that the downy woodpecker, the closer and closer it got to looking like a hairy woodpecker, the less it got bullied and picked on. Okay, maybe. You know, this is, they're grasping at straws a little bit. All right, yeah, that could be. But now there's scientists who are saying actually it could be the opposite. Because the hairy woodpecker is actually known to be kind of a bully. And if you do have a bird feeder, you'll see this, that whoever else is there, if it's covered in finches and sparrows and nuthatches, whoever's there, when the hairy woodpecker flies in, they spook everybody off. They're aggressive, and they express their dominance, and they'll do that, you know, in the woods, but you really can see it on a feeder. And so now the thought is actually that the little smaller downy woodpecker that doesn't have the bronze as much to dominate other birds maybe gets that same response of deference by looking like the hairy woodpecker. Mm. Either way, super interesting. And to me, it just seems like a, you know, really prime example of how even our most basic assumptions about the most common birds that we're familiar with every day can be totally turned on its head by just closer observation. And so, you know, I just, because so many people are familiar with those birds, I thought I would share that story. And there's something similar, and I won't go into it. I think that was enough of that. But there's something similar happening with sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks, which are also fairly common birds. We have both of them right here in this region. They're a forest-hunting hawk, previously both known as accipiters, although I think they're saying that they're, one of them isn't even an accipiter anymore, which is the kind of hawk. And again, they look very, very, very similar, but maybe are not even related. So we are 20 minutes into the hour, so I'm going to take a moment to hear some words from our community, and then we'll get back to join our conversation with Derek Furr.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Smisath from HomeShare Ulster County. If you're a homeowner with extra living space, or if you're looking for affordable housing yourself, HomeShare Ulster County matches home providers who have extra living space with someone seeking an affordable rent. We provide a fully supported matching process with trained volunteers and a thorough vetting process guided by your choices. It starts with filling out an application and conducting an intake interview. Then we'll ask about your background, lifestyle preferences, and communication style. Once you've chosen your housemate, you'll draft an agreement for home sharing, and we'll continue to offer you support for the lifetime of the match. Please note that we're not a program for immediate or emergency housing. We're a program of Family of Woodstock, and we serve the City of Kingston through our office at 31 Albany Avenue on the third floor. You can call us at 845-331-7080, extension 162, or look for HomeShare Ulster County at familyofwoodstockinc.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices, one community.
Hi, I'm Nick Pankin. Join me for Freedom Highway, Sunday nights from 10 to midnight here on Radio Kingston. We're a musical inquiry into where each of us fits into the established order.
What are you doing toward the scheme of things?
Which side are you on, my people? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
We're listening to songs that give voice to the ongoing struggle and our hopes to create a world that belongs to all people. Freedom Highway, Sunday nights from 10 to midnight here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Unicorn Bar is hosting the Last Days of Disco fundraiser for Gateway Hudson Valley, Saturday, March 29th. Attendees are invited to put on their best bell bottoms, platform shoes, and boogie while Boston DJ Spezio plays throwback tunes. Tickets are $25 in advance, $30 at the door, and the party is free to attend after 10 p.m. All cover charges will go to Gateway Hudson Valley's program for adults with disabilities. Last Days of Disco fundraiser, Saturday, March 29th, from 7:30 p.m. to midnight at Unicorn Bar, 224 Foxhall Avenue in Kingston. For tickets and more information, ghv.org. Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we are joined today in the studio by a special guest, Derek Furr. Derek Furr grew up in rural North Carolina and taught public schools in Charlottesville, Virginia for many years. And now he lives with his family and has for, I think, at least 20 years in the Hudson Valley. And he's a literature professor and the dean of teacher education at Bard College. He's the author of three collections of poetry and prose, Love Story with Birds being the most recent, and we're going to read and hear about today, and then previously Sweet for Three Voices and Semitones, as well as critical works about poetry, sound, and performance. And Derek is also an active participant and was a speaker this week at the quarterly meeting of the John Burroughs Natural History Society. And so, Derek, thank you for being here in the studio with us again.
Yes, glad to be here.
I wanted to open with, you know, I got to see you talk a little bit the other night at the John Burroughs Natural History Society meeting. And, you know, you mentioned sort of developing your interest and passion in birds, you know, later in your life.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear just a little bit about your journey and if there's any spark experiences that really kind of turned the corner for you or, you know, or landscape for that matter that just really opened your attunement to the natural world.
Mm. That's an interesting question. I mean, there's a way in which there's a long answer and a short answer. I'll give the medium answer, which is that I think I had always been, you know, interested in the natural world, but moving here actually in 2004 made a big difference for me. So I'd always lived in the South. We moved to this new place. There was a lot that was new and a way in which I felt very disoriented. And one way to orient myself I found was just to go out and try to find what was going on in the landscape. And sometimes this is just a way of sort of quieting my mind, you know, and this has always been an important practice for me. But it was spring and I heard, you know, there are lots of warblers in this area during migration. And I took my trusty Petersons and my tiny, not very good binoculars and went down to Kingston Point and saw my first yellow warbler. And I was hooked, you know. And for me, I think it's always been a kind of local practice, as to say that I'm most interested in what is right around me. Just to be attuned to the environment and to the place, you know, what makes it this place are these creatures that we share the place with. And so, yeah, I think I did come relatively late, if you think about it. I mean, I was already a grown-up, so to speak. but this is a great place to develop an interest in birding.
Yeah. That's great. I loved your use of the word orientation. I can really relate to that. I travel quite a bit for work and in life. And I feel like when I arrive someplace, I'm often, disoriented until I have that opportunity to step outside and just who's around, what, you know, what trees are growing, what birds are singing. And then that's how I feel grounded in place, wherever in the world that is.
Yeah. I find that to be the same. I travel some for work too. And some of the experiences that really sort of establish me where I am, even if it's just for a week or two, have to do with an encounter with, you know, the more than human, so to speak, another fellow creature.
Yeah. Well, it's so great. I, you know, as a lifelong naturalist myself, and I'm a big advocate for the pursuit of natural history, but I, you know, to me, that very much means kind of an expansive definition. You know, it's hard science is so important. I mean, absolutely critical, right? We need hard science so that we can make smart decisions about the land and so that we can understand, how, you know, what's impacting species. But when it comes to natural history, hard science is just one part of it. I believe that, you know, very strongly that the sort of human subjective experience is equally valid and important. And then the next step in that is the interpretation, you know, is taking that observation, understanding of the natural world, and then being able to, you know, in your case, writing. So this is where I'm going with that, you know, using art in many different forms or literature to capture something about that. And what's captured is partly objective and external, and partly it's very subjective in your own experience. And so I'd love to hear from you, you know, in what ways maybe your kind of attunement to the natural world has, you know, started to inform your, you know, practice as a writer or vice versa.
So maybe it would help to anchor that in this book a little bit. So the book is called Love Story with Birds, and I get asked occasionally if it's a bird book, and I have to say no, it's a book that has birds in it. But it's a great question because at the heart of it, I think, is a question about what we do when we write about the natural world. What would you do when we write about our fellow creatures? And I'm really conscious of the ethics of that. That's to say that if I'm writing about a bird, is it a means to an end, or is the bird an end in itself, right? And it's rarely either, it's rarely one thing or the other, but for me, those creatures find their way into my writing. I can't keep them out. And what I end up wanting to do is represent an experience and hopefully find a way to invite other people into that encounter. You know, I don't, how to say, I would hesitate to call myself a naturalist. I feel like I'm too much of a dilettante in that respect. But I try to pay close attention to the creatures that are I'm trying to represent, but also to the language with which I'm doing that. Mm-hmm. I think there's actually a strong relationship between attunement to the environment and attunement to the written word. I'm a lit teacher, right? I mean, and we talk about close reading. And close reading is all about paying very careful attention to the form of the text as well as what it's saying. And to me, that's a very similar practice, right? Like what, not just a sort of that I'm hearing birds, but what exactly am I hearing? What birds am I hearing, you know? And how are those sounds changing over time, and et cetera?
Yeah. You know? Well, I think that might be a great little foundation setting if you would be game to read to read some pieces.
Sure.
I know that you had one called Green Heron, or about a green heron, mm. that I just particularly, you know, well, certainly could relate to.
Sure.
But also, I know you have a series of sort of very short little bird captures that could also be great.
Sure. Do you have a preference which one I start with?
Well, let's do Green Heron.
Okay, we can start with Green Heron. So this is an essay in several parts. I'll just read the first part. A lot of this book takes place in Kingston, actually, is set at the Kingston Point or Sleitsburg Spit in this area. And so this piece is called Green Heron, On Dwelling in Possibility. A green heron flew out of the reeds and landed on a fallen tree where the Rondout Creek empties into the Hudson River. It paused, motionless, and became invisible. Had I not seen it fly in, I might never have seen it at all unless it moved. Occasionally it did, first a slow skulking down the limb, later a spreading of a wing like a cape over its head and down its side, like a magician whose exaggerated flourishes announce the drama about to unfold. But that comparison suggests a performance. The heron was not performing. Whether drying its wing or shielding itself from the sun, it moved in secret. These were private, practical acts, not intended for my binoculars. Meanwhile, near me, a fledgling tree swallow had ventured to the tip of an oak branch that stretched over the water. It perched, bunched up and silent, until its parents swept over with food. Insect remains from the mosquitoes, damselflies, and sweat bees that populated the air just above the estuary waters. A squadron of tree and bank swallows dove and skimmed, and the fledgling was a beneficiary. When its parent approached, it fluffed up and squawked, as if to give her a bigger target. The parent remained airborne during each feeding, none of which lasted more than a second. A second green heron emerged from a bank of cattails, and the contrast with the swallow's intensive hunting and feeding was striking. It showed no interest in the first heron. Stretching its long neck, it moved without reference to the magician's display, though the two seemed to engage in tai chi, graceful and slow under the sun, not consciously linked to each other, let alone to the swallow's aerobatics or me. A green heron isn't very green. You might be disappointed if you expect the cardinal or blue jay's technicolor dream coat. His crest and back are opalescent, shading from dull gray to viridian, like the forest canopy when the sun hits it just right. What you likely noticed first are the brown and white stripes of his belly that provide camouflage among the reeds where he lurks. Slinks, my wife Carolyn said, skulking about. She and my sons teased me for watching a YouTube video of a green heron, about 8 minutes of amateur footage of one on a riverbank. There was no sinister plot, but skulk was the right word for the bird's movement. That I found this captivating has been a reference point any time I become self-righteous about what passes for entertainment among the young these days, or complain about the noisiness of modern movies or the shimmering nothingness of social media feeds. What could compare to that skulking green heron, they say, who isn't even green? Between DC and Marvel, we have Green Arrow and Green Lantern, Hawkeye and Falcon. Birds and greenness, but no one thought to create a green heron. Any wonder? Fair enough. Although his long beak could be a bayonet or lance, he's not otherwise superhero material. Then again, recall the monastic hero of the 1970s television series Kung Fu. The show capitalized on the popularity of Bruce Lee films and a vogue for martial arts and, inexplicably, cast a white man of Irish descent, David Carradine, as a mixed-race Asian American in the Wild West. My elementary school friends and I were captivated by it. One scene in particular stands out. In fact, it's the only one that I can recall. Kwai Chung Kane's master directs our hero to walk on rice paper without crinkling or tearing it. He fails repeatedly, until he learns to quiet his body. The necessary poise and agility for expertise in martial arts won't follow. In third grade, we took butcher paper from the school supply closet and tried it ourselves. Why were bony redneck third graders drawn to an exercise of balletic grace? We imagined that skulking undetected was a prelude to an attack. Such agility would be combined with the speed and strength that allowed Bruce Lee to rip out a man's heart and show it to him before he died. I never saw that film scene, but others swore they had, and while we argued over whether the movie was real, no one doubted that a master of Lee or Kane's caliber could do it. A heron slips along the shoreline as if on rice paper. A great angler, he will place a reflective object on the water's surface, a pin oak leaf, for example, and watch for a fish to investigate. The heron's patience, driven by necessity, far outstrips mine. 15 minutes in, and I lower the binoculars to look for other birds. Meanwhile, the green heron waits, motionless, seemingly dispassionate, until a fish is in range and he strikes. Is it hyperbole to compare the jolt to lightning? His long neck shooting out and snapping back, he breaks the water's surface like a diver with barely a ripple and comes back with the catch. He is fed because he waited, quiet and watchful.
Beautiful. Oh, thank you, Derek. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Nature Nuggets, and we were just hearing an excerpt from Derek Furr's new book, Love Story with Birds. Derek is an author and literature professor at Bard, and I am going to take the liberty of saying local naturalist, even if he's shy about it. I think... the level of attention and observation that you are demonstrating through your work, I think is you know, absolute classic naturalist behavior. But I love that piece. You know, personally, I think we share some of the same haunts. I love spending time at Sleitsburg Spit and going down to the mouth of the Rondout, and also the Kingston Point Trail area has become my, you know, kind of go-to afternoon if I just have an hour to spare. And I've had an experience with green heron down there that I can, yeah, relate to. They and you really did capture something essential about the essence of a green heron. They are a whole mood. You know, they really, they can seem, you know, grumpy. They can seem, you know, profoundly elegant. And then at the next minute they can squawk and look, you know, gangly and you know, awkward. But, you know, that's something, you know, the closer we look, the more we find. And I really appreciate that capture of some essential essence of an animal, because it's just like people. You know, once you you know, get to know somebody, you inevitably gain affection, and then that affection, you know, it can turn into understanding and solidarity, and all these things are related. But the first, it starts with looking and appreciating. And birds are such individual creatures. They all have such different personalities and different ways of moving through the world. And, you know, I love that. Green heron is another one where once you start to kind of know what they like, you start to kind of, you know, you might move through a landscape and turn a corner and look at an area and go, that's where the green heron should be.
Yes.
And that to me is, that's the next level of being a naturalist, kind of, is when you have that experience and then that happens. And the green heron, not because you've seen it there before, but because you thought that looks like where that's a green heron would want to be. Yeah. So that's really cool. Well, maybe we could do a couple more. I really appreciated, you know, just kind of speaking about the captures. You have a series of real short individual bird, I think just a few lines a piece.
Yeah.
Maybe we could do a handful of those.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is, there's a series of poems in the middle of the book called Sunday's List. And these were really the poems that generated the book. I had been writing I'd finished my book Semitones and had tried to write a novel. I discovered I'm not a novelist. I worked on this thing for a long time and I just kept not coming together. And at the dinner table, I was probably whining and my wife said, could you just write a few little poems about birds? And it was one of those suggestions that sort of, you know, you need as a writer. It kind of unstuck me, as it were, because I was going down to the point all the time. And so I just started writing. This is the most cliche thing in the world, to write poems about birds, right? But to do it well is actually therefore very hard. And I tried to do it well. I wrote a lot of poems that were no good, in my opinion. The ones that are in the book are the ones that I feel like have something to say. So I'll read just a few. These, as you said, Laurel, these are all very short, like 4 or 5 lines. And they each are named for the species. So it's Sunday's List. Morning dove, appeared to us. Imagine a door opens, folded linen, a breeze, disturbance and joy. Tree swallows, apoplectic, fidgety in line, a row of first grade boys until they dive down and skim the river of the sunlit morning river hunting. Yellow warblers, exuberant, unabashed, scarlet stretch marks, their tiny bellows bulge. Common yellow throat. Why not masked warbler? This one skulks in marsh grass. Its mate in olive drab lets show a golden neckerchief. You mentioned sharpshinned hawk earlier, so
yeah.
Sharpshinned hawk. It peels from the hemlock bark. Sparrows bicker in the spilled millet. When they scatter, it's too late. Marsh wren. I waded through poison ivy to see you. Invisible, you did not move. You sang and sang among the cattails. Failing, I was not unhappy. Maybe I'll read this. This one called Ring-billed Gulls, because we have so very many of them.
Yeah.
Down to the point, year-round. They leap up, hover, and descend, changing order on the sandbar, the trawler muttering in the fog, staining it diesel. And they squawk shamelessly, a joyful noise, because joy is shameless. Red-winged blackbirds. A legion swoops down on the reeds, epaulettes flashing. They sway on the tips. They rattle and chime. The sky over them opens.
I love it. Thank you. There's so much captured in there. And, you know, it just, knowing each of those birds, you know, somewhat intimately, it's a delight to hear. Indeed, you know, there is something shameless about a ring-billed gull, and you know, in the way that they, you know, and you know, you got me, feeling you know, real missing of tree swallows and anticipation for them coming back. And just that image of them, you know, it's true on the wire, but a bunch of first grade boys, I think you said, until, and then, you know, you didn't even have to say it, but until they alight, and then the elegance emerges, you know, and they're, and so that is wonderful. And, you know, a couple things really seem to come through. Well, one, just, you know, your love for birds is clear, but also deeply embedded in so much of your writing is your love for Kingston, which you said before. And I think that's just so cool. You know, there's something about, there's intimacy with other creatures and that, you know, deeper knowing, but then there's also, you know, that kind of relationship with the landscape. And I think sometimes people don't think about it in the same way they think about human relationships. But you can absolutely love a landscape, you know, every bit, if not more deeply than you can love a, you know, a human being. And and so it's really great when that comes through in some of just the context that you're setting and the place names and the creatures that are expressions of place. That's very cool. Well, yeah, you know, the other thing you've said is that it's as much about, I think you said the book is as much about attention as it is about birds. Right. And yeah, I'm curious just to hear you maybe say a little bit more about that, you know, because, you know, we can go outside and we can put our earphones in and kind of just do a brisk walk and still get some exercise. And it's refreshing. Yeah. It's good for us. We should, better than nothing, but it's also different to stop the chattering a bit or allow it to stop. And sink into the landscape a little bit. I'd love to hear you maybe just say a tiny bit more about sort of, you know, your experience like that.
Yeah, I think there's something I've been thinking a lot about for several years as a teacher. And many teachers will tell you this. There's so many distractions. It's difficult to train our attention on a book, for instance, for long enough to actually finish the book, let alone really get into the book. And I see there's clearly a similarity there to what's going on around us. And you're right, I mean, I'm a runner. I have been since I was a teenager. And I've never worn like headphones as I run. And it's partly because I'm afraid I would get hit, but it's also that part of the reason I started that, I think, even when I was younger, was a sense of trying to get away from the noise of the world, you know, and also to shut down the noise in your mind, because I was a distance runner for a long time. And you get to a certain stage in a long distance run where you actually stop thinking about all the stuff that's going on in the world and in your life. And it makes you in some ways more aware of the world that you're actually inhabiting. And so for me, this is why I go for walks by the river. It's why if I have a minute, I'll do that. Because I think it's not an escape. I think it's quite the opposite from an escape. It's like a becoming aware that many of us need desperately, it seems to me. And so the book is a lot about that at various angles. Much of the book was written during the pandemic when we were forced to slow down. But yet, there was a tendency in mass culture not to pay attention to the level of suffering that was really happening and the things that we could be doing. And unfortunately, we're in a similar space again. And I feel that some of this is about a lack of empathy and connection to the greater world, as well as to our fellow humans. So there's a lot in the book that's about that dilemma. And my real belief is that if we, or hope, I put it in terms of a hope, is that if we're more attuned to the creatures that are right beside us as conscious beings, I would say, you know, birds are more conscious than we probably care to realize, right? So are mice. So are, you know, so many different of our fellow creatures are aware of themselves and aware of you and have a life that is rich. And I feel like if we can kind of connect to that, it might be disruptive of sort of destructive behaviors that we just engage in with unconsciously.
Yeah. Well articulated. I couldn't agree with that sentiment more. And it certainly, it's reciprocal, of course. It goes both ways.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned empathy. And so, you know, but our own mental health and well-being and sort of emotional sanity is just so deeply benefited by spending some time outside. There's just a perspective, yeah, when you slow down and realize, okay, everything may seem like darkness and chaos, you know, on our news feed, but actually, you know, here come the spring birds and the spring peepers, and life goes on, you know, as it has. And in fact, many places in our region are ecologically more healthy maybe now than they were decades ago. There's, you know, and sort of it gives a little bit of some deep breaths. And then vice versa, you know, the natural world at this point very much depends on our attention, if, you know, to stay healthy, because as I start the show with every year, every week, you know, we won't fight for what we don't love, and we can't love what we don't know. And so the more we understand the landscape we're living in, the less likely we are to clumsily destroy it without understanding that we're even doing so.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, this is a great conversation, and I look forward to coming back to it after we take a quick break for some final words from the community.
Hi, I'm Kristen Kessler from the City of Kingston's Department of Health and Wellness. We'd like to invite you to Kingston Eats, the citywide Harvest of the Month campaign, where celebrating healthy, local food is fun. This year, we're focusing on the abundance that is grown near us in the Hudson Valley. Look for upcoming Harvest of the Months like potatoes, beans, asparagus, and more. As always, there will be menu specials at local restaurants, free produce at participating local food pantries, free cooking workshops, and fun school-based and daycare activities for our youngest community members. If you can't make it out to a special event, you can also find Kingston Eats online on Facebook and Instagram at LiveWellKingston and using the hashtag KingstonEatsFresh. You can get more information on participating locations when you click Eat Well at LiveWellKingston.org.
Top of the day to you. Hi, I'm Anna Brett.
And I'm Ken Brett. And we're inviting you to join us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. for the Irish Show.
We're brought to you by the men and women of the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
Tune in to hear the best of Irish music through the ages, from lively dance tunes to jigs and reels to sentimental two-step.
We'll also give you the latest updates on Irish and Irish-American activities in the Hudson Valley.
You'll hear about the birthdays of our listeners as well as other important events in their lives.
And you'll laugh and or cry at our collection of Irish proverbs every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. on Radio Kingston.
AM 1490.
FM 1079.
And anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we're having a wonderful conversation with local author, naturalist, and literature professor at Bard College, Derek Furr. And he's been reading us some selections from a recent book of his called Love Story with Birds. And if you have just caught a little snippet of this conversation and you'd like to hear the whole thing, I will be archiving today's episode along with every episode we've done, which you can find on radiokingston.org under Nature Nuggets. You can also find us. We have a little bit of an Instagram presence if you're on that platform. We are at HV Nature Nuggets, so you can follow us there. And then lastly, if you want to contact the show directly, you can email us with show ideas or questions, naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. So we've got just a handful of minutes left, and there's so much more we could discuss, but I wanted to, well, first of all, this book that we've been hearing from and talking about, Love Story with Birds, I know you can order it online. That's what I did because I had a limited amount of time, but you can also find it locally. Is that right?
That's right. I've seen a copy at Rough Draft. Local bookstores will order it for you as well.
Yeah. Great. And I'd love, you know, if you could just talk about the proceeds. If someone buys this book, where do those go?
Yeah. This is true for all my books, actually. I donate the proceeds to the Blue Fridge Hunger Relief Program, which is on Clinton Avenue at the One Hope Community. So some of you may know there's literally a blue refrigerator outdoors there. And it's a drop food off, pick food up as you will program. And it's been thriving for several years since the pandemic, but could always use donations. And so I donate all of the proceeds from this book to that program.
That's so great. Thank you. All right, with just a few minutes left, I wanted to introduce, I saw in your bio that you also teach for the Bard Prison Initiative, which sounds really interesting and would love to hear more. And it sounds like that's woven its way as well into your writing in this book.
That's right. So I do teach for BPI. And one of the ways that I've taught, all Bard students complete a senior project. And a few years ago now, one of my students wrote his project on a medieval Japanese poet, Ikkyu. And this was a sort of introduction for me to this poet and then to a whole kind of poetry that honestly I had very little knowledge of at the time. But it also picked up on another thing that interested me, which is Zen Buddhism. And this student was a practitioner himself. And I feel as though, I don't know that he would know this of himself, but he became a kind of master to me, you know what I mean? And it sort of recognized how the practice was helping him survive in a very difficult environment. And so I became interested in Buddhism and read a lot of Buddhist texts. And I think that ends up being echoed in many of the poems in Love Story with Birds. So there's a lot in the text that necessarily comes from my own experiences in Christianity, but there's also a lot of reference to Buddhism and in both traditions, the practice of attention and attentiveness. So I had thought about, and I think there's maybe just enough time for me to read a poem called The Meadow.
Okay.
Along those lines. Crossing a meadow with no horizon, I came upon a man in a wooden chair that needed to be re-caned. He perched on the back with a bucket between his knees. "For rainwater?" I asked, and he nodded. Sometimes a goldfinch visits and sips. Grass had just begun to break the sod. "Am I walking in the right direction?" He removed his straw hat and waved, ran his hand across his baldness, stroked his long beard. "Everyone asks that," he said. "Spring has arrived. There will be more light and fragrance." He replaced his hat and offered water from a tin ladle on the bucket. I had not known how thirsty I was. I worried about taking too much. He assured me that it would rain soon enough, even pour down. A barrel would be too small. "What about shelter?" I asked, seeing no trees or cliffs, only a meadow. "You're wearing a cap," he noted, "and that overcoat should shed water. Tuck your shoes under your arm and don't put them on again till your feet dry." I thanked him for his advice. Further on, clouds gathered, flocks of finches, dozens, then hundreds, descended gold and purple on the meadow. To my surprise, they were silent. I held out my cap, and one flew in, a house finch, missing an eye. "What happened?" I thought. She must have read my face. "Hailstone, when we cross the gulf, don't be concerned. The benefit of a flock is we guide each other." She preened while she spoke, or sang. Her speech was melodic, like a recitative, and confident. "How far to the meadow's edge? You must have crossed it in flight." She ignored my question. "In time, you will come to a pecan tree. The ground is covered with nuts, no one harvested. Fill your cap and pockets." I scanned the meadow, but saw no tree. "Dare I ask how far?" I dared ask. My finch hovered by my ear. "Would you walk faster or slower if you knew?" Lifting all at once, the flocks caused a breeze that raked across the tiny meadow grasses. It smelled of cinnamon. I cannot say how long I walked. Night came and went and came again. Rain fell and slaked my thirst. I slept while walking as if in a dream until the tree was before me. In its broad shade, I lay against the trunk and cracked pecans in my palms. The meadow stretched endless around me. North, south, east, west. "Is this all?" I wondered aloud. A breeze rattled the branches in bud. I foresaw the catkins in new fruit. A downpour under 10,000 leaves, their slow shedding of green for gold. A fire in winter kindled from windfall. And the grass supped, sufficient for you.
Perfect timing. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that, Derek. That is from his recent book, Love Story with Birds, which you can find locally. I really appreciate you taking the time to come in with your Saturday morning and share with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it, Laurel.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Take care.
Give myself.